I'm here today with Douglas Brower. Doug is the author of a new book titled Chasing After Wind, A Pastor's Life. Doug is a retired Presbyterian pastor who served churches in Pennsylvania, Illinois, Michigan, Florida, and Zurich, Switzerland. He has a bachelor's in philosophy from Calvin University and master's and doctoral degrees from Princeton Theological Seminary. His other books include Remembering the Faith, What Christians Believe, and How to Become a Multicultural Church. You can learn more at dougsblog.substack.com. So Doug, welcome and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you for the introduction and thank you for having me, Brian.
Well, it's really a pleasure to get to know another great person who I know lots of folks in common with. So it's really good to share that. But in any event, I mean, please tell folks more about your background than what I briefly touched on.
Well, what's interesting to know, and it's interesting because I touch on this quite a bit in the book, is where I grew up. I'm a product of the Dutch Calvinist immigration to Western Michigan, and those are the people who shaped and formed my faith. Just to give you an illustration of that, beginning in third grade, I and my classmates were required to start memorizing the Heidelberg Catechism.
Wow.
And the idea was that by the time we were high school seniors, we would recite from memory the entire catechism to the elders of the church, which we did. Hard to believe now.
Yeah.
And only then were we deemed mature enough to join the church and to be allowed at the Lord's table. So I come from that background, and Calvin College, now Calvin University, is certainly part of that Dutch Calvinist system.
Yes, absolutely. So I mentioned that, you had written several previous books. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yes, I've now published 5 books with the Urbans Publishing Company, which I'm proud of. It's a 100-year-old family publisher in Western Michigan. And in fact, I worked there for a summer as a college student and even played on the company softball team. The and in spite of that, they continued to write books. The first 3 books I did were products of adult education classes that I taught for the congregations I served. I would come to the end of these adult education classes and I would think, well, I put a lot of work into this and there's a lot of research involved. I think there's a book here. Hmm. And Erdmans agreed with me. So those first 3 books grew out of what I produced for my churches along the way. Then that fourth book, you mentioned that I served a church in Zurich, Switzerland. That fourth book grew out of a life-changing experience of serving a multicultural congregation. The church there had more than 24 nationalities or language groups on any given Sunday morning.
Wow.
And this was so different from the, the homogeneous congregations, mostly white congregations I served. And it was difficult. I mean, in some ways, it was beautiful and wonderful. Communion Sundays were, still bring tears to my eyes. But it was also hard work. And so I thought of 10 ways that churches could become more multicultural. 10 reasons why my church in Zurich works and that churches in North America often don't.
Wow. Well, that's fascinating. That had to be an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Switzerland itself, just as a country, has multiple languages within its borders. Yes. I know. I mean,
so what we had in common was a Christian faith and the English language, which some of us spoke better than others. And beyond that, we had virtually nothing in common. So every day was a learning experience, learning about the cultures I interacted with. I just thought it was one of the greatest gifts at the end of my ministry career.
Well, I can totally see how that would be the case. I know all my international business experience was so incredibly valuable throughout the years, having gone to several different countries and learned, what it's like there. So
yeah.
I totally hear what you're saying. So let's get to the new book. I mentioned the title is Chasing After Wind, A Pastor's Life. What motivated you to write that?
Yeah, so Almost as soon as I retired, within days of retirement, I did a little bit of traveling, but as soon as I came home to the U.S., I found myself plunged into a life review, which I didn't want, but somehow couldn't avoid. It was there. And so for weeks, really, months maybe, I found myself thinking about my entire ministry career. Did it amount to anything? In the book, I use the image of a house painter. And this may not be accurate because I don't know many house painters, but in my imagination, a house painter at the end of the day can see what's been accomplished. There's something to look at. And so I thought, for a pastor, what in the world is there to look at? And of course, there are things that I'm very, very proud of, and I mentioned those in the book, but there are other things that that I still wonder about. So to explain the title, whenever my family gathered at my grandmother's dinner table, it was customary for us to have a Bible reading and prayer at the end of the meal, and my grandmother would always read from the book of Ecclesiastes. And I didn't think it was humorous at the time. It was puzzling, but I didn't smile about it. But in those first two chapters of Ecclesiastes, there is this refrain. This is not an exact quote, but I considered all that my hands had done, and it was a chasing, and it was a vanity and a chasing after wind. So that phrase has been with me. I think it was probably an assessment of my grandmother's life, looking back. And I think it's an accurate description of a lot of my ministry activity. I think a lot of what I did was a chasing after wind. It didn't, you know, I'm very proud of some parts, as I said, but a lot of it didn't add up to very much.
Well, I don't know if I would conclude with the last part of that, but, you know, I certainly relate to the whole idea of chasing the wind. I mean, we're all trying to grasp what God is and what God wants, and we're never going to, you know, completely, right? I mean, that's almost by definition ungraspable for humans. Right.
You know, so, okay, if you follow the narrative arc of the book, there is this profound disillusionment at an early stage of my ministry. But by the end, I think what redeems the book and makes it worth reading is this coming around again to what's essential about the faith. And what's essential about being a pastor. It took me far too long to learn. And maybe most people at the end of their careers will see themselves in that. But by the end of my career, I think I had come that full circle to understand what was valuable about my life and work.
So if I could, I'd like to read one of the reviews of the book. This one written by Tim Brown, former president of Western Theological Seminary, who we both know. He says, Douglas Brower's memoir on pastoral work is a gem and a treasure that will be known as such for a long time to come. Eugene Peterson lamented in his book, Working the Angles, The Shape of Pastoral Integrity, he said that pastors are abandoning their posts left and right and at an alarming rate. The pastors of America have metamorphosed into a company of shopkeepers. He certainly wasn't thinking of Douglas Brower when he wrote that. I have known Doug for a very long time, and he is the real deal. His memoir is a pure gift.
You can't pay for words like that. That's wonderful. Thank you, Tim. But the truth is, I wish I had listened more to Eugene Peterson. I read his books along the way, and Eugene Peterson did not find himself caught up in ambition. He stayed with one congregation throughout, I think, the entire 30-plus years of his parish ministry. And he consistently took a Sabbath each week where he refreshed himself spiritually and so on, reconnected with the God who had called him to the work. Well, for some reason, I read the books that he produced, but I ignored everything he had to say. And only in retirement do I realize I should have paid more attention to him.
Wow, that's interesting. So another, you know, writer that we both have tremendous respect for is Frederick Buechner. Yeah. How would you say he influenced your work and your writing?
You know, I haven't thought about this before. That's a good question. I think one of the reasons I was drawn to Buechner was that he was both a pastor and a writer. And I guess you could say the same thing about Eugene Peterson. I was drawn to him for the same reason. Somehow he mixed ministry and writing. Although in Buechner's case, I think his congregation was all of North America and beyond. Yeah, and I count myself a member of his congregation. His writings were eloquent, and they spoke to me. I quoted from him probably way too much. You know, a church member should have taken me aside and said, you know, Doug, do you read anything else? But he was Frederick Buechner was a formative voice in my preaching life. His insights were, you know, second to none.
I won't argue that for one moment.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of memoirs from pastors out there. What would you say makes this one stand out?
You know, is that true? I hope there's not too much competition in the marketplace. In my mind, what I thought when I was setting out here was that I wanted this to be different from the Father Tim series set in Mitford. And I think Jan Caron, the author, has produced now 14 volumes in that series, and these books have made it to the New York Times bestseller list, and I haven't read all of them. But in the ones I have read, I had the feeling that this was not a realistic portrayal of ministry. Maybe it is for some. You know, maybe there are some Father Tims in the church, and if so, I'm delighted. But I think, this is my guess in writing, that there are many more people like me who went through tough times and struggled and wondered about the worth of what we were doing. You know, so Father Tim never had those doubts. I certainly did. So I was writing in setting out to write this. I wanted to be different from Father Tim. I wanted to tell my story.
Interesting that was, you know, the influence that you had on that.
Yeah. And it, as I say, nothing against Jan Caron, a terrific author, but I do want to stand in contrast.
Sure. So in the book, you mentioned holy bits. Can you talk about holy bits?
Okay. So I mentioned the narrative arc of the book, and looking back, I wish I had spent far more time with the holy bits of ministry and less time with administration and running a big, taking care of a big building and all those things that took too much of my time. The holy bits refer to those moments in ministry where God breaks through and is present in the life of a pastor and in the life of a church. That chapter begins with the baptism of my older daughter, who is now a Presbyterian pastor. I was about a third of the way through that baptism when I started crying. And I couldn't go on. And then my senior pastor at the time sort of took over. So this was a tag team baptism. He added the Son and the Holy Spirit at the end. And then that chapter concludes with my daughter's ordination and to ministry and the opportunity I had to preach the sermon and lay hands on her. Those moments and all those moments in between turn out to be what makes what we do worthwhile. And in fact, I think that my job, if I wish I recognized this earlier, my job was to point to those holy bits to say, do you see that? You know, that's God breaking through. And I wish you would notice that. So I would lead people to the presence of the holy if that's where they wanted to go.
Well, I just recently did an interview for another book that's just coming out from Patrick Henry. It's called Glimpses of Grace and 33 Encounters with God. And so his entire book is basically, you know, pointing out some of the holy bits in his life.
Sounds like one I need to read.
a lot of, you know, similarity. But anyway, so obviously with the pandemic, before the pandemic, I mean, pastors are under immense pressure from a lot of different directions. And with the pandemic added on top of that, it's been really, really difficult for folks. So there's been the Great Resignation, which, you know, is a term that's been used not just for pastors, but, you know, more broadly. But can you talk about what you've seen of the phenomenon of, you know, pastors now deciding that's enough?
Yeah. As it turns out, about 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, the Christian Century published an article, and I forget the title now, but the first line was, if you want to be rich, get an MBA. If you want to be happy, get an MDiv. I mean, almost an exact quote of the first sentence. And then the article goes on to explain that pastors at the time, again, just 20 years ago, ranked second on the job satisfaction index.
Wow.
So pastors were right up there just behind physical therapists, I think. they were at the top. Well, in 20 years, that has reversed itself. Pastors are no longer near the top, and I don't know if they're close to the bottom, but they certainly seem to be. The Barna Research Group published a poll not so long ago and noted that close to a third of all pastors have seriously considered quitting their jobs in the last year. And if you look at a younger age group, that percentage goes up. And if you look at mainline pastors, it goes up even higher. I think it's closer to 40% of mainline pastors have thought about bailing out. So this goes way back before, you know, the 2016 election, which was very divisive in our country. And there's been a steady erosion of satisfaction over the last 20 years. And now we're living with the result of it, that people are thinking, maybe there's another place where I can use my gifts.
Well, what do you think the answer is? What do we do about it?
I wish I knew, Brian, but here's a guess. I think we need to take a look at the relationship between pastor and congregation again and rethink that relationship. I think there was a time when pastors had a clear clear identity, but then there were clear expectations on the part of congregations for their pastors. And my sense of it is, my experience is that a lot of that has gone away. Pastors are wondering about their identity, and congregations are wondering about what they can expect from their pastors. So this is not going to happen overnight, but I think in the next few years, there needs to be this reexamination of pastors and churches and how they get along with each other. That's where I would start.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think a big part of that has to be the economic model of a church, right? Where, you know, there's two things that really bother me about it. One is the enormous amount of money that is spent on buildings and grounds, maintenance, so for all that. The second is that in at least a lot of church environments, the pastor's salary is dependent upon keeping the congregation happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which is to me a very fundamental conflict of interest. You know, those are not aligned objectives in my mind in terms of what a pastor really, you know, should be doing is all about versus keeping a bunch of people happy.
Well, some congregations need comforting, but sometimes the gospel is disturbing, and pastors need the freedom to say where it's disturbing.
Yeah, so I agree with you about the need for a relook.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, interesting you should mention the economic model. I take long walks with my daughter and hear her. I try to keep quiet, and I listen to her talk about leading a church these days. And her experience is so different from my own. And part of it's driven, a big part of it's driven by the economic reality of church life today.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I can totally see. I mean, it's affecting everyone. I mean, I can totally see that. So back to the book, what would you say is like the number one thing that you'd want people to take away from it?
You know, pastors are not alone in doing life reviews. And what I want to say to the reader is it's okay to look back. And it's okay to be, I don't know about brutally honest, but it's okay to be very honest with yourself about what worked and what didn't work in your career. And then coming to terms with that is actually a very healthy step to take in retirement. I'm proud of some things. I'm not proud of others. I'm going to kind of lift up those things I'm not proud of so that people like my daughter don't make those same mistakes as she goes through her life as a ministry. I think that's my, that's the hope I have for a takeaway from this book. It's okay to take an honest, realistic look at what ministry looks like these days.
So, as you know, a lot of our audience are writers, aspiring writers.
Yes.
What type of advice do you have for folks who are just getting started?
You know, last fall I taught a class on memoir writing for a lifelong learners group here in Holland, Michigan. And after the first class, I was just filled with self-doubt. I thought, you know, these people just want to hear someone say, let her rip. They don't need all the mechanics, all the descriptions of narrative arcs and so on. They just need somebody to say, you can do it. And then whatever, you know, whatever mechanics you do need to learn about writing and creating a narrative arc and so on, you can learn that later. I think back to the time I learned to play golf. The foursome I was with knew that this was my first round, and they were giving me advice about grip and stance and swing. And, you know, someone should have said to me, just hit the ball as hard as you can. Now, can I, I'm going to give the other side to that too. I'm grateful that airline pilots and surgeons and plumbers get some training before they do what they do. But if you have a story to tell, my hope is that you'll just let her rip. Tell your story, and then you can find an editor later who will help massage it into shape.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good advice. So looking forward, anything you can talk about in terms of future projects?
You know, I had a project in mind before the pandemic. This book turned out to be my pandemic project. But before the pandemic occurred, I was thinking about writing stories about or profiling flourishing congregations. For 17 years, I served on the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship, and we gave away lots of money. We gave away other people's money to churches that were doing creative things. And sometimes it was so wonderful, so imaginative. And so we would fund them, and then we'd receive their reports, and we would meet the leadership and so on. And I've since gone off that board, but I continue to think about these people, and I would like to visit them and then tell their stories. And now that I can get on an airplane again and not worry too much about getting sick, I think I would like to revisit that project, because I think there's a need for some models of what a flourishing congregation looks like these days.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Doug, I mean, congratulations again on the book and all of your work. And again, the name of the new book is Chasing After Wind, A Pastor's Life from Erdmans. And you can learn more about Doug and the book at dougsblog.substack.com. So, Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.